going to go into the part three, which is about the post-Christian. And this is where missions equals re-evangelism. But I'm nuancing this by saying re-evangelism via unity and diversity. So not just re-evangelism as in telling them the good news again, because you know what? The good news is not even news to them anymore. They hear Jesus is Lord or Jesus died for you on the cross, and they're like, whatever, we've heard this. Like I said before, to a lot of people in post-Christian contexts, this is old news, this is passé, it might as well be mythology. You might as well tell them that Zeus still exists, right? Or that to them, Jesus is the same, right? Or Jesus is a swear word, or that's all they know it as. Or it's their parents' or their grandparents' faith, but it's not their faith. It's the church is irrelevant. But there is hope. Romans chapter 11, Paul says, he's talking about the Jews here, who once were the keepers of the faith. Did they stumble so as to fall beyond recovery? Not at all. Rather, because of their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel envious. But if their transgression means riches for the world, and their loss means riches for the Gentiles, how much greater riches will their full inclusion bring? Even though Paul was the missionary to the Gentiles, he still cared about the Jews. He did not consider the Jews a lost cause. He said they were the originals. And not that, you know, Westerners are the originals of the faith, obviously, but we sometimes think they are. That's right. Jesus came to America and spoke English. No, wait, we're not Mormon, right? So but we often think of the West as being like the center of the faith. And now that the West has lost the faith, is there hope for them? Do we give up on the West? Do we say, who cares? You know, do we try? Are they beyond recovery? And I think no, they're not beyond recovery. We need people to focus on them. But unfortunately, because, you know, as we talked about with world Christianity, we so often think of Christianity as being linked with the wealthy and the poor are the non-Christians. Well, actually, in this case, in day and age, actually, a lot of the wealthy are the non-Christians. And we talk about the context of Japan is a prime example, but also Europe. And so this is something that we really need to tackle for that reason. So as I said, the U.S. tends to be a little bit of an outlier in the sense because of the next evangelicalism, how immigrants and ethnic minorities tend to keep Christianity afloat in the U.S. But I would say that trend is disappearing even now, especially as we get to younger generations like Generation Z, and millennials. So I'm going to focus a lot on that today because I feel like that's pretty important to know. But definitely in places like Canada, Australia, and most of Europe, Christianity is all but dead. You know, it's like it's really a marginalized faith. So let's unpack this. What's that, Kyle? Oh, did you say something? Okay. All right. I do need to unpack these terms, though, as we're going to talk about the post-Christian. Relativism and pluralism. Relativism is that truth is decided by the beholder. That's not a good thing. I mean, you might as well be universalistic, right, at this point. Anything goes, as long as I believe it, it must be true. And I mean, that's a bad way to live. That's unrealistic and... you can't always just make your own truth. So I think Christians are right to push back against relativism. But I think that a lot of times we confuse it or conflate it with pluralism. Pluralism is the fact that there exists a diversity of peoples, cultures, religions, and worldviews in this world. And that is simply a fact. You cannot dispute that fact. But the tricky thing where it gets a little confusing is when pluralism becomes a value. Now, is pluralism as a value, not just a fact, good or bad? What would you guys say? Pluralism as a value, good or bad? Saying that we have a diversity of these things is a good thing. Like, should we aim for a diversity of these things?
Because they're all valid.
Right. So the reason why you guys are hesitating is because it depends what we're talking about. It all depends. Like, Do we think that having a multiplicity of cultures is good? I would hope so. We're missionaries, right? And God's kingdom is diverse, and you know, in Revelation 7:9, every tongue, tribe, nation will be worshiping around the throne. That's wonderful. And frankly, I'm so glad I live in a place like LA, because the food, man, the food. Like, I would die if I couldn't go down the street and have Mexican food and Japanese food and Ethiopian food, like whatever. So I realize that I'm being spoiled here, but I love the diversity of cultures. But as Christians, and especially as evangelical Christians, diversity of religions? I would hope not. I would hope that we all want everyone in the world to worship Jesus as Lord. So the reason why it's complicated is because pluralism is value. Yes and no, right? But with the younger generation, especially post-Christians, they say a resounding yes to the pluralism as a value completely. They don't know how to distinguish between these two. And so for them, they're like, oh, multiplicity of cultures, great. Multiplicity of religions, great. Multiplicity of sexuality and gender identification, great, right? They lump it all together because everything pluralistic is good for them, right? So, and instead of parsing, well, some yes, some no, right? It depends what we're talking about. So we definitely don't want to be relativistic, but some aspects of pluralism we like, right? So, and I think this is where sometimes, like, I definitely run into some problems with some conservative theologians from America, because with regard to pluralism, they will say no to the entire thing, yeah. Right? They're just like, because unlike the post-Christian, which will say yes to pluralism as a value in its entirety, conservative Christian theologians in the U.S. will say no to it in its entirety. Missiologists are trying to keep the tension between, you know, some yes, some no, right? So it depends what it is. So, all right. John Piper actually, first let me quote Rabbi Zacharias on relativism. Relativism as a philosophy of life cannot be true. Think of the statement, all truth is relative. Now, if truth is relative and you stick by that statement, then it even includes that statement, which means that statement itself is relative and therefore not always true. Or if it excludes that statement, but then it ends up positing an absolute while denying that absolutes actually exist. So one way or another, the scheme of relativism self-destructs under its own weight. But John Piper is an advocate of diversity, which is a kind of pluralism. And in his missions book, Let the Nations Be Glad, he says, there is a beauty and power of praise that comes from unity and diversity that is greater than that which comes from unity alone. I infer from this that the beauty and power of praise that will come to the Lord from the diversity of the nations are greater than the beauty and power that would come to him if the chorus of the redeemed were culturally uniform. The reason for this can be seen in the analogy of a choir, where depth and beauty is felt from a choir that sings in parts than from a choir that sings only in unison. Unity and diversity is more beautiful and more powerful than the unity of uniformity. In fact, if we're Americans, then we know this, because right on our money is stamped the Latin phrase e pluribus unum, which means
one from many.
Now, one out of many, one, that's unity and diversity. The fact that we have one federal government, we have 50 states that all operate, you know, with diversity, but yet we're all under the Constitution, that's unity and diversity. And I think there is something beautiful about this, and there's something very Christian about this. We talked about in yesterday's talk about the reconciliation of Paul saying a church must have different races and genders and social classes and ages. That is the picture of a church. There should be unity and diversity. In 1 Corinthians 12, Paul talks about this. The body, right, is made up of many parts, and the eye and the hand and the feet and, I mean, ears. You can't say we don't need each other, right? We all do different things, but we're all part of one. We honor each other in our diversity. So that's, it's a very biblical concept. And unfortunately, people, like I said, conflate pluralism with relativism and throw out the baby with the bathwater. And we need to make sure we distinguish between those two. Okay. So I want to talk about, at this point, shift gears a little bit, about worldviews. We touched upon this yesterday a bit, with pre-modernism and modernism. But I really want to lay out the whole spectrum here for you guys, because I think this is really important as we're thinking about how to engage with post-Christian people. Pre-modernism, if you remember, or sorry, let's put it this way. Modernism is defined as in the advent of the Enlightenment. This was like 18th century when the Enlightenment started, right? And this is when the Western world decided, hey, everything is reduced to the brain, logic, and science. So if it's not provable or visible or verifiable by logic, the brain, and science, it doesn't exist. It's not a fact. It's not relevant. Okay? So this is the decline of religion, and it started the decline of religion, and it started the decline of values and morals. Because if everything is reduced to the brain, science, and logic, then, right, that was the Enlightenment. That was the beginning of modernism. Pre-modernism is before that. Right? So before that, people were open to the supernatural, to the spiritual. We talked about the flaw of the excluded middle was the result of modernism, but there was no excluded middle in pre-modernism. And then post-modernism is a reaction against modernism. We'll unpack this. So there are good and bad about all of these. The pro about pre-modernism is that they believed in God. Everyone believed in God. I mean, in pre-modernism, there wasn't hardly anybody who didn't believe in God. The question is, which God? So, for example, we see in the beginning of the book of Acts, you see Peter healing the lame man at the beautiful gates. And, you know, and I think with our modernist lenses, we often read that story and go, oh, this person didn't believe in God, and now he believes in God because he was healed by Jesus. Actually, that's a completely misreading of that story. That's a modernist reading of that story. A pre-modern reading of that story would be like, of course that man believed in God, but the question is, which God? He worshipped probably the Greek god of healing, Asclepius. And Peter came and said, don't worship Asclepius, worship Jesus. Right? So he switched gods. It wasn't he went from atheism to religion. He went from one god to another god. So that's a pre-modernist understanding. Belief in God is an awareness of spiritual realities and open to miracles. These are all good things about pre-modernism that Christians can use to our advantage. Some of the cons is that it could also include everything under the sun, including animism, superstition, polytheism, and pantheism. Now, it is interesting that a lot of Western conservative theologians tend towards modernism. And I do think that there's a lot of good about modernism. They believe in absolute truth, and they believe in logic, that God must make sense to some degree. So, but there definitely are some bad things about modernism. Excessive individualism, anthropocentrism, which focused, like, centered on human beings, belief in humanity to accomplish anything, secularism, and interestingly, logic. Logic could be a pro or a con. The con is if we're trying to make God fit every single systematic box we create for him. I think this is why Westerners always argue about Calvinism versus Arminianism and stuff like that. And I'm like, you know what? It's honestly both and. God is sovereign and he gives us free will. It's both and. But because if you put everything in systematic boxes, you have cognitive dissonance and you have to separate them. And it's like, no, actually, it's both. I think that what happens is that a lot of conservative Western theologians only focus on the absolute truth bit. And they go, okay, therefore I'm all in with modernism. I'm like, wait a minute. Don't forget that modernism did a number on us. The 20th century was the great secular century. It was the century of modernism, where you threw out religion and you replaced it with anthropocentrism. And what did you get? Marxism, communism, Nazism, fascism, the Great Depression, World War I and World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam, the Cold War. You throw out religion, that's what you get. You get secularism, atheism. 20th century was the bloodiest century in human history, and it was the most secular. So when people today say, oh, religion is the cause of all evils in this world, right? You might have heard people say that. I'm like, you're only thinking since 9/11, right? It's like, go back to the 20th century and like do your homework, because you throw out religion, that this is what you get. And so it kind of baffles me a little bit that sometimes conservative Western theologians align themselves with modernism. Because I'm like, you do realize what modernism did to us. This is bad stuff, right? So, and there's also a neutral about modernism, science and technology. It all depends what you do with it. The internet, good or bad, right? Well, you could spread the gospel. You could also look at porn. Airplanes, good or bad. You could go on short-term mission trips. You could also crash them into the Twin Towers. Like, it really depends what you do with it. So, but we live in a world of science and technology. And then postmodernism. I think often postmodernism gets vilified by conservative Western theologians because of the whole relativism thing. Mm-hmm. People say, oh, modernism is just absolute truth, and postmodernism is all relativism. I'm like, let's be a little more nuanced than that. Postmodernism, there's some good stuff that comes with it. Community, relationships, realization of human depravity. Look, you know why postmoderns rejected modernism? Because of all that bad stuff I just said about the 20th century. They're like, modernism doesn't solve problems. In fact, it made the earth worse, right? We're dropping atomic bombs on each other and gassing people in chambers. It's like, that's so they're like, I don't want modernism. You don't have to convince postmoderns that humans are evil. They realize, they get human depravity. They're not like, oh, humans have unlimited potential. Postmoderns are like, yeah, I'm cynical about humanity. But they love authenticity. And they're open to spiritual things. Not necessarily open to organized religion, but they're open to spirituality. Okay? So that was one of the cons that I just mentioned. And but they can also be relativistic, and they can be excessively cynical. I think realizing human depravity is one thing. To be excessively cynical is another, right? I think a lot of people these days think that cynicism is the same as realism. Mm. And they think that anything positive is just idealism. And I think being excessively cynical is also sometimes very unrealistic as well, right? I've talked to people who about, you know, they say, what is heaven like? And I'm like, you know, according to the Bible, no crying, weeping, mourning, pain. What did the postmodern generation say? That doesn't sound real. I don't know if I want to go there. Sounds fake. I'm like, really? You want to go to a place that has pain and suffering and weeping and mourning? And to them, if it doesn't have pain, it's not real. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow. Like, that is something when people actually will reject the good in favor of the bad because only the bad feels real to them. That's excessive cynicism, right? So I think we need to be aware of that. Okay, so we were talking about in the previous section about, in the first section about the Eugenitis tripartite, you know, gospel, guilt, innocence, honor, shame. So I want to unpack that bit. What's the difference between guilt and shame? And I was saying that actually a lot of Western post-Christian people are actually gravitating away from guilt, more towards shame. In many ways, postmodern, post-Christian Westerners are becoming, in many ways, like more similar to honor-shame-based societies, especially like Japan, okay? I mean, it's interesting because I had my students, you know, do projects for their final paper, and a bunch of them picked Japan for some reason, you know, as their project. I was like, okay, so they were doing their reports on Japan, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, there's so much depression, and there's, you know, suicide, and you know, lack of hope, and they feel like, and then I talk to my students, and I'm like, my students feel like that too. I feel like Japan is where American students are going to be in like a few years, right? It really feels so similar. And part of it is the honor shame framework, which honestly a lot of that comes from social media. Mm. Social media use increases the honor shame thing. Mm. We'll talk more about that in just a bit. But the difference between guilt and shame is, guilt is I'm sorry I made a mistake. Shame is I'm sorry I am a mistake. Guilt is I did bad. Shame is I am bad. Brené Brown, author of Daring Greatly, said, shame is the fear of disconnection because of something we have done or failed to do so that people see themselves as not worthy of love or belonging. So guilt leads to shame. But I think shame is more deeply rooted because it is the entirety of us. It's not just our hands, what we've done. It's our identity, it's our being. Yeah, exactly. And you know what? Westerners understand this. Let's take, you know, Bill Clinton or O.J. Simpson, right? I mean, you know, they both went to trial and both of them were declared innocent by the courts. But their guilt may be exonerated. They didn't go to jail for what they did, but the shame remains. They got that stigma, that scarlet letter on them, right? And that is just much more, like, you can bet Bill Clinton for the rest of, if he could erase the history books, he would. Because for the rest of history, he's going to have that scarlet letter on him, right? He's going to have Monica Gate, like, hanging over him for the rest of history. That's what, I think if getting rid of the shame is more important than getting rid of the guilt, I think, in many ways. So, yeah.
To add to your commentary, because I think it is really a critical issue in not just North America, but anyway, because Brené Brown misses a piece in there.
Yeah.
Something we have done or failed to do, or was done to us.
Mm.
So sexual exploitation.
Wow, I like that.
It's a huge category where the victims of sexual exploitation, and the shame of that is not addressed by the sinner. And need a savior.
Wow.
That does not speak to the victim of sexual exploitation.
You're right. You're right.
So whether it be China or Japan or the United States, we have to reframe our discussion of what the cross means to a victim of sin.
Yeah.
We still need Jesus' forgiveness and cleansing.
Wow.
Cleansing. They can use a different word. Restoration.
Yes.
Which are all biblical principles.
Yes.
But we only focus on guilt.
Mm.
So this is thought down there that with a big topic of sexual.
I will definitely add that next time. Yes, because if you're only focusing on actions, people who are victims, they didn't do anything, and then they're like, well, where do I stand then in this? Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm. So as I was saying, Gen Z in many ways are under shame society. Honor shame is something that we see a lot in the Bible, especially in the Gospel of John. Let's see.
Callan, would you give your age definition of Gen Z?
You know what? I will do that, and that's the in two slides. We'll do that. Let me just give a biblical basis here. And by the way, one last thing about guilt versus shame. And my wife and I, we've been married 4 years, 4.5 years. And so one of the things we really wanted to do when we first got married is to go to marriage counseling, not because our marriage was bad, but because we wanted to make sure it didn't go off the rails, right? Because we're like, a lot of people only go to marriage counseling when their marriage goes off the rails. And we're like, nah, prevention is the best medicine, right? So, and I'm so glad we did, because, you know, some of the things we learned is, you know, how you communicate with each other is you don't, focusing on the action is one thing, but focusing on the identity is another thing, right? So, for example, the marriage counselor said, like, let's say I leave my dirty socks on the floor or something, then my wife could either say, can you please pick up those socks because, you know, that... I don't like the mess in the house. That's focusing on the action. But if she says, you are such a slob, that's character assassination. That's identity, right? And a lot of times marriages fall apart because people do character assassination. They don't just focus on the action. They focus on the identity of the person. It's like, I'm stabbing you to the heart because you are just this way, right? And so I think that's, well, that's why shame is like such a more damaging thing to people, because when you assassinate the character, right? So, yeah. Honor shame's stories from especially the Gospel of John. I mean, you think about John 2, the wedding feast at Cana, right? where Jesus turned water into wine. He didn't forgive anybody's sin. He didn't, you know, feed the hungry. He didn't raise anybody from the dead. He saved the honor, the face of the wedding couple from being shamed. And then all these people gave their trust to Jesus in that moment because he did this. Because that's so important to people. Or John 3 and 4. Have you ever thought of comparing and contrasting Nicodemus with the woman at the well? I think you need to read John 3 and 4 together. Because Nicodemus, you have this respected Pharisee who goes to Jesus, and you know, and you have the woman at the well who's of the wrong ethnicity. She's a Samaritan. She's the wrong gender. She's a woman. She's the wrong social class because she's was socially stigmatized because of her what she's done. And but the difference, and this is kind of a interesting thing that some people don't notice, right between the two stories, Jesus talks about darkness and light. And then it says Nicodemus went to Jesus at night, and Jesus went to the woman. It's interesting. Nicodemus went to Jesus, but Jesus went to the woman. Jesus went to the woman during the daytime. And he says, anyone who's in the light will have everything exposed. But that's a good thing, you know. So he literally exposed everything about her and said, yeah, you've had all these husbands and whatnot. But these are really stories of honor and shame. Nicodemus went to Jesus at night because he was ashamed of Jesus. He didn't want to be seen with him. And whereas the woman went to the well during the day at high noon in the Middle East because she was ashamed of herself. She did not want to meet anyone. And you go to the well during the middle of the day because when it's hottest, because no one's there. So it's interesting that Nicodemus didn't receive the gospel at that point, but the woman at the well does. Right? So there's really honor shame stuff going on here. Okay. So Randy, you were asking about definition of generations. Here we go. Actually, I want to get a show of hands in this room. Does anyone identify as Gen Z here? Born between 1984 to... Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? Ah, I got those dates wrong. The Gen Y and Z dates should be flipped. Yeah. So, Gen Z, born between 2002 to 2015. And Gen Z's here. Millennials. Okay, you guys are millennials. Gen X or Busters. That's me. Okay, and some, a lot of you. Boomers. Boomers. Okay, a few boomers. Yeah. Presume no elders here. All right. So when I started teaching at Biola 11 years ago, my students were all millennials, and now they're all Gen Z. So I've seen the transition, and I've seen the shift. There's many similarities between the two, but also some differences. So one of the big differences between millennials and Gen Z is trauma. I think Gen Z is the first generation that was born post 9/11, and also the 2008 financial crisis, the recession, caused a very low birth rate in that year. And we're seeing that in the ramifications of colleges. In a few years, colleges are going to receive all the students that were born in 2008, and there's a huge drop-off in population. So all these colleges are freaking out because we're like, oh, we're not going to have enough students. And for all tuition-based institutions, which are, most Christian universities are very tuition-based, they don't have huge endowments. And so it's, we're kind of scared, like, are we going to be able to remain financially solvent if we don't have enough students? So, you know, this Gen Z, I'm a Gen Xer, as I said, and Gen Xers I think in general, we're pretty positive about the world because we didn't grow up with a lot of trauma. I mean, I grew up in the 80s. What happened in the 80s? Like, Reagan won the Cold War, right? I mean, it was pretty cool. We're watching Back to the Future, and our future was like flying cars and hoverboards, right? And things like that. Gen Z, they're like, they've gone through trauma, right? They've gone through these things. And then in addition, their future is not flying cars, right? It's like Priuses because you gotta save gas, right? This is a different world. It's a world where the climate change is happening and, you know, our world might go to ruin, and so you gotta be careful. So instead of hope, it's like cynicism, right? So, and, you know, even knowing that it's hard because, you know, I went to undergrad at Yale. When I was applying to Yale, it was a 17% acceptance rate. Do you know what it is today? 6%. I'm like, I don't know if I would get into Yale if I applied today, right? So things are harder for Gen Z than they were for Gen Xers, right? So life is more difficult and they're facing more trials and they often don't know how to cope with it, or we need to give them strategies on how to cope with it, right? So I talked about the cynicism, depression, sometimes suicidal. Okay, so I want to talk about some American Gen Z characteristics, and I got a lot of this data, most of this data, from David Kinnaman, who is the head of the Barna Group. The Barna Group is like a think tank that, Christian think tank that does statistics and surveys, polls. They're kind of like the Christian equivalent of the Gallup polls, right? David Kinnaman actually is a graduate of Biola, and I've heard him speak a few times, and so these are some of the things he says about Gen Z. They're very diverse. Diversity is a hallmark of who they are. I talked about the fact that you know, pluralism is a value of Gen Z. Whether good or bad, they just take it all. All pluralism is great for them, right? But definitely ethnic pluralism and cultural and they're used to this, and they regularly interact with people who are different from themselves. But they are also very career-driven. They care about career. Now, what's very interesting about this is that they also care about social justice, right? You talk to them, and they want to save the world, but they also want to save themselves. A lot of the reason that they are career driven, and I see this as the young people are coming to college, and the number one thing that they want is return on investment. I hear this from parents and from the students. They always ask, what kind of job will I get when I graduate, and how much money will I make? That's like their number one concern. In my day and age, education was about character formation and learning how to think and, you know, broadening your mind and things like that. Today they're like money, success. And you know what? Honestly, I don't blame them. If their life is shaped by the 2008 financial recession, they're like, I need to know how to survive, right? Maslow's hierarchy, physiological, right? The bottom one is survival. Like, will I even have enough money to put food on the table? Will I even have enough money to be able to survive or even pay off my college debt? These are questions they want to know. And so a lot of this is not necessarily driven by selfishness, although it might be. It's about survival. So it's there's insecurity about their life. And so they have big dreams and hopes. On the one hand, they want to save the world. But on the other hand, they're not even sure if they themselves will survive. So it's like, that's a tension. Look at this. What is important to their sense of self? Professional or educational achievements tops the list for Gen Z. Entertainment, hobbies, pastimes would be number two. Gender, sexuality would be number three. Okay. Religion is somewhere in the middle, and politics are closer to the bottom. So you look at millennials, Gen X, and boomers, they will prioritize some of these things differently. But I think it's important to notice what rises to the top. Mm-hmm. What are the values that rise to the top?
Alan, is some of this related, though, to age as a cohort, so that, you know, as people get older, no matter what cohort they're in, they're going to be more concerned about certain things, like politics and religion. And so when you compare the four categories...
It depends what year you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. I think you may be right. But certainly there, at least, I would say that Gen Z has certain characteristics that, like, for example, Gen Xers never went through at their age, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So like the sexuality thing, for example, is a big one, right? So let's look at that one for a second. But I think you're absolutely right that it's a function of where you are in your stage of life. What percentage of America do you think identifies as LGBTQ? Just in general, overall America, what percentage of America identifies as LGBTQ?
3%.
It seems much bigger from that, from the media, because it is always... My wife and I, we love watching TV, and we noticed every TV show has someone LGBTQ in it.
Yeah.
Every single one. 100%. You know, and as an Asian, I'm like, you never see an Asian on TV, right? It's like, how come... And Asians are like 5% of America, and LGBTQ is 3% of America. So I'm like, what's going on here? Because the big three, honestly, are blacks, women, and LGBTQ. Those are the big three, like, civil rights, social justice groups that you cannot say anything negative about in the media.
Right.
If you do, you will be just excoriated, right? You'll be slaughtered, you will lose your job, whatever. People get fired over this stuff. But all other groups, you could say lots of bad stuff about them and no one cares. It's like, so anyway. But 3% is actually LGBTQ. What percentage is of Gen Z identifies as LGBTQ? So this is something which is a big marker of who they are. And even if they don't identify as such, most of them support it, right? This is like, so 33% say gender is how a person feels, not their birth sex. So that is another big thing. Another poll, what does happiness look like? Again, success tops the list. Family, education, spiritual, and health. Spiritual is pretty low. And even their physical health, that seems kind of interesting. Because in many ways, I'm thinking, without your health, like, again, the Maslow's hierarchy, physiological, your health is... I'm like, why do you care about financial, but not health? Because those are both, like, you know, you need those to survive. But for some reason, it's just not really on their radar as much. But spiritual either. So they don't, maybe it's more of a focus on the here and now rather than on the later, right? But also Gen Zers are in the prime of their health, so maybe that's
yeah.
you know, function of it. Their body's not breaking down yet, so they don't care. They don't think about it. Another thing is Gen Z is post-Christian. 34% identify their religious affiliation as atheist, agnostic, or none. So there's actually a phrase. They call them the nuns, right? To encapsulate all of this. 34% are the nuns. But not only that, morality is not a big thing for them. Only 34% say lying is morally wrong. They don't think lying is a big deal. In fact, because they're also addicted to screens, a lot of them don't think pornography is wrong. In fact, there was a poll done of, like, according to Gen Z, what's their worst, what are the worst possible sins according to them? Not just Christians, but, like, you know, in overall Gen Z. And I think near the top was ruining the environment, but near the bottom was pornography. So for them, environmental concern is greater than moral, you know, purity, right? So,
depression.
Yeah.
it's interesting because the connection's not made between that and sex trafficking, which is a high value, or
yes.
Sex trafficking.
Yes.
I found that an interesting conversation in recent years that has not seen that there's any link between them.
Yeah. You know, I think they try to distinguish between sex that is consensual versus sex that is non-consensual. So sex trafficking would be non-consensual. But if it's consensual, they're like, anything goes. So they're, yeah. Only 33% think that the Bible would have a positive effect on politicians, as opposed to Gen Xers, which would say 48%. Boomers would say 66, and elders would say 74. Yeah. And only 4% have a biblical worldview. I talked about this in yesterday's lecture briefly, but moralistic therapeutic deism is really what their religion is, for even the Christians, right? The people who profess to be Christians. And so it's not really Christianity. So... All right. And then technology is a big thing for them. When asked if looking at other people's posts often makes me feel bad about the lack of excitement in my own life, Gen Zs definitely do. They're the most users of media and screens. And but screens have really messed with them. Screens have affected people, distracting their minds, seducing their hearts. It personalizes suffering, weaponizes humor, increases skepticism, disempowers persuasion, and broadens worldviews. The last one is not a bad thing, but all the rest, I think, are kind of problematic, right? So the problem is screens are actually what they're addicted to. It's what they're seeing all the time. How many hours per year do they look at or get spiritual content? Like church sermons and whatnot, you know, 153 hours for non-churchgoers, 291 hours for churchgoers. How many hours per year do they spend on social media screens? 2,767 on average. Screens are discipling this younger generation more than anything else. Okay. This is where they're getting their, not just screens in terms of like social media, but movies too, right? And things like that, binging Netflix. So these things, are really affecting them. But here's the thing. Lest we say, well, how awful Gen Z is, they seem like they're going down the tubes because all the, it's all these characteristics. You know, parents of Gen Z are at fault too. Where did they get these things from? Parents are also addicted to social media, parents of Gen Z. They often are looking at their screens instead of being present for their kids. So they stick the screen in front of their kids to babysit them. So there isn't a sense of the parents actually being present and parenting these kids, engaging them, talking to them, playing with them. There's a phenomenon known as snowplow parents. You pave the way in front of your kids so that they never encounter any obstacles, that their path is free and clear for them. Problem is, then you don't know how to handle difficulties when they arise. And then sharenting. Oversharing about their kids on social media, which is something that my wife and I have been made aware of recently. And so we just had a baby and we're like, you know what? We're not going to post the gazillion pictures of our baby on social media because he's his own person. He has autonomy. What's happening is a lot of... kids, they get to teenage years, then they are Googling themselves and finding all this embarrassing stuff about them online that they never posted themselves. Mm-hmm. And their whole life is laid out. And so I realized that, you know, sharenting, people didn't realize the effects of this until very recently. Mm-hmm. Also, people didn't realize that screens rewire people's brains. Here's the thing, Gen Xers may be addicted to screens, but we started getting addicted to screens after we were fully formed as adults. Gen Z get addicted to screens while they're being formed. It literally rewires your brain. It causes the neurons and everything. It causes attention deficit disorder. Kids these days can't even sit through like a 1 hour episode of TV. They are watching YouTube primarily, 3 minute clips, right? And so that's their attention span. The problem is when every time you look at the screen, you get a dopamine hit. It's a pleasure sensor, right? And the more you look at your screen, the more dopamine. But then you get desensitized to it, and the more you do it, the more you need it. And it's a vicious cycle. And so let me just try to land the plane here. Oh, and by the way, just the snowplow parents. I want to point out something about this. Jonathan Haidt, NYU professor, wrote a book recently called The Coddling of the American Mind, How Parents Are Setting Up Their Kids for Failure. And he says, one of the things that we really need to do is not snowplow. We need to let them climb over their own obstacles. This is called grit. Angela Duckworth, professor at University of Pennsylvania, wrote a book called Grit, New York Times bestseller, and she says, the number one indicator of success in life is not actually intelligence or skill, it's grit. Can you persevere even after you've failed? A lot of Gen Zers fail and they give up. But grit. Jonathan Haidt actually gives an example of this. He says that peanut allergies. You notice how many kids have peanut allergies these days? Why is that? He says, because parents are so afraid that their kids are going to have peanut allergies that they never give them peanuts. Well, guess what? That's what causes the peanut allergies, because you're never exposed to peanuts. If you are exposed to peanuts at a young age, you will develop a tolerance for them. And so in life, what happens is we don't expose our kids to hardship, and then they get to the hardship later on in life and they don't know how to handle it. The more you expose them to it, the more they can handle it, right? So grit. Okay, how to minister Gen Z. This is from David Kinnaman. Define and develop resilience disciples. This is what I was just talking about with grit. Be confident Christianity answers today's complicated issues. I think we sometimes might feel as older generation that the younger generation doesn't care about the Bible, and so we don't give them the Bible. Actually, the Bible is something which is a guide for all of life. We need to change our pedagogy. Mm-hmm. Don't just lecture at them. I think we need to engage them. Realize doubt and honest questions are powerful drivers of faith formation, not just pat answers. Connect to real life, work, relationships, sexuality, ambition, money, because these are their values. Meet them where they're at. Stop blaming and labeling them like they're all snowflakes, they're all fragile. Well, we happen to have a president who's like snowflake in chief, right? So it's like... Sorry for getting political, but I'm like, it's not just Gen Z who's fragile, right? So we need to show strength and resilience and courage. Don't be self-righteous against them. Mm-hmm. Be open about your journey. Yeah. It's not easy. Say, you know what? You do have it harder than we have it. Educate with the next generation. Be a learner yourself. Acknowledge their world is more difficult. Don't be afraid to say, I don't know, and I'm sorry.
Yes, amen.
Have young people engage the Bible communally. And focus on cultivating discernment. Maybe teach out of the wisdom literature. So here are some just my personal takeaways from all this. You know, they've been shaped by trauma and technology. They're both modern and postmodern. I think they hold them both They might be like, oh yeah, you know, I like community and I like spirituality, but they're also very, sometimes very atheistic and science oriented. They have both worldviews, innocence, guilt, and honor, shame. They're individualistic and collectivist. They want to make a difference in this world, social justice, but they also want to be successful in their own lives. Many times the latter wins out over the former. They love diversity and thrive in it, but they put sexuality and race in the same category, and they just lump them all together. They love technology, don't always know how to responsibly manage it. Mm. And the older generations are responsible to guide them, but also have contributed to their development in both good and bad ways. So this is a reality of what we're facing with post-Christian people. It is a different world. And I think we can't just use our classic ways of doing missions, you know, assuming that missions is just overseas or it's only in poor countries. But it's right here. It is in the West. It is among the young people. Young people have so much potential, but they need to be brought up right in it. And a lot of times the older generation have failed them, right? So, but I don't think they're beyond rescue or beyond hope or beyond recapturing. So I think it behooves us to go that way. All right.